session number 4816, Reel 1.
Commander Moran, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, Commander Moran, when you joined the Navy in the first place?
Well, I joined the Royal Navy proper in 1934. I was in the RNR until then, and had been mainly working up and down the South American coast with my old company, the Royal Mail Steam Packet Company, and got fed up to the hilt with it. And in 1934, when the Navy was calling for people to transfer, I jumped at the chance. So there it was, 1934, I joined the Royal Navy.
Now, we can't go into your early service, but in 1940-41, you found yourself on the North Atlantic Patrol.
Yes.
Can you tell me what the function of that was?
Yes, I was on the Malvernian, HMS Malvernian, which was an ocean boarding vessel. And we were part of the North Atlantic Patrol, but our specific job was contraband control. We had our square of the North Atlantic to patrol. We'd go out from the tail of the bank, which was our base, with a convoy. We'd be a convoy escort on the way out, branch off, find our square of the North Atlantic, and just patrol up and down, looking for ships that came our way. And our job was to identify, to challenge every ship we saw, to identify them. If necessary, send an inspection party aboard to examine their papers, check their cargo, and so on. If we had suspicions about them, we sent a prize crew aboard and sent them into a contraband port.
What did you say the name of the base was?
The tail of the bank at Greenock.
And what were your own duties on board ship?
Well, I was supply officer. This was my prime job. I looked after the pay, the stores, the victualling, all that side of the ship. But in addition, I was cipher officer and ship's photographer. I was ship's photographer solely because I was the only one on board who had photographic equipment on board and who could process the films afterwards, because with each boarding report we sent to Admiralty, we were asked to send a photograph of the ship we'd boarded. So I was also sort of semi-official ship's photographer. I was also a lifeboat officer and a gunnery officer. In other words, in action, I looked after one of the machine guns. So it was a wide variety of duties.
Was this your own photographic equipment?
Yes, it was my own, yes. Oh, yes.
What type of contraband were you finding?
Well, anything. Well, we didn't actually find the contraband. We had our suspicions. We didn't unload the ship. If we felt suspicious about a ship, or if we were certain that it was a ship taking goods to Germany or to German-occupied countries, we put a prize crew aboard, and we carried, I think it was three prize crews on the Malvernian, and if necessary, we put a prize crew aboard, send the ship into Halifax, Nova Scotia, which was our contraband control port, and let them look after it when the ship got there. So our job was purely to intercept ships at sea, to make sure that they weren't acting contrary to our interests. And if they were, or if we felt they were, then when we went into action.
Now, in 1941, you were captured.
Yes.
Can you tell me how that came about?
Yes. I suppose the story started. I was on cipher duty one night. My cipher watch was from midnight to 0400. And we had a signal from Admiralty, which I deciphered, to say that a German freighter had been reported having left New York. This was before America was in the war, and it was felt that she might cross our patrol area, and would we look out for her? And if possible, a Catalina flying boat would be sent out to assist us in the search. Our patrol area then was somewhere about 600 miles west of Finisterre out in the Atlantic. So I deciphered the signal, took it up to the old man, and next morning got up at the usual time, had breakfast, filled my pipe, went out on deck, and suddenly spotted an aircraft low over the horizon. So I rushed back to my cabin to get a camera. By the time I got out on deck, action stations went. And instead of one aircraft, there were four aircraft. So I rushed back to my cabin again to get my tin hat and up on the bridge where my action stations were up on the bridge. And by then, these aircraft were over the ship and dropping their bombs. With their first flight over, they hit us with three bombs. And one of them was a 1,000-kilo bomb. It was the only bomb we were able to identify afterwards before the ship was finally finished. They hit us with these three bombs. One of them went straight through down into the engine room. Of course, destroyed everything there, killed all the engine room staff who were on duty down there. Another went through through one deck, through the signals office, and through the sick bay, killed everyone there. And we had 10 communications cadets with us on that particular patrol. The Admiralty had sent them to sea, which was, I gather, a normal custom for sea experience. These were youngsters, 18, 19, whatever their ages were, who'd finished their training and were sent to sea on a patrol for sea experience. And we had these 10 lads with us. They were all killed. The Focke-Wulf Condors flew over, dropping more bombs. They didn't hit us again. There were a couple of near misses. In fact, up on the bridge after the first flight over, the old man said to me, "Well, I think we can do without you up here." So I went down onto the main deck when one of these bombs came down, a near miss, and it sent tons of water inboard, picked me up, and carried me from one end of the ship right down to the other. And I remember that so very, very clearly, because all I was worried about was my camera. I got my camera around my shoulders, and I thought, "Christ, this is going to ruin my bloody camera." Apparently it didn't. Which I heard later on, the camera was okay. But the Focke-Wulfs flew over and around the ship and shelled the decks. And I imagine they pushed off when they'd expended all their bombs and ammunition. We manned our guns. We had 2 6-inch guns, plus the machine guns, and these were all manned. But the machine guns were put out of action almost immediately. The upper deck was complete shambles, you know, completely destroyed. And the aircraft pushed off. The ship was on fire and was listing badly. It wasn't entirely on fire. We were able to get down into the engine room, and a couple of chaps got down into the engine room and brought a few bodies up from there. We managed to get into the canteen and grab some cigarettes and some bars of chocolate and one or two other things. And then we buried the chaps over the side. I can still remember number one wondering if we got a prayer book around. Nobody got a prayer book on him, and nobody knew where to find one or in any place where you could go and look. We shoved these chaps over the side as best we could and said whatever prayers we could remember. And by that time the ship was burning furiously and listing over. The next thing, obviously, was to get some lifeboats in the water. We carried, I really forget how many lifeboats we carried. I think it was 4 lifeboats we carried, 2 on the port side, 2 on the starboard side. plus the whaler. The whaler was completely destroyed, and the lifeboats themselves looked in a pretty bad way. But the davits and the falls were all cockeyed. The davits were all bent. You couldn't launch your boats in the normal sort of way. We couldn't launch the boats on the port side of the ship because that was high up over the water, and you got the side of the ship at an angle there. You couldn't launch the boats there, so we just had the two boats on the starboard side, the side that was leaning over, that we could launch. We had to cut the falls of the boats. No other way of launching them. I mean, the mechanism was all destroyed, so you couldn't lower the boats in a normal sort of way. So the only way to get them into the water was to just cut the falls with an axe and let the boats fall into the water. And we got two boats into the water. We lost everything in the boats when they fell into the water. We lost the mast and the sails and all the lifeboat rations, the water kegs. Everything fell out of the boats, but we got the boats. We got the boats themselves into the water. The next thing was to have a discussion and see what could be done about it. We had no communications because our communications office had been completely destroyed. But everybody got into the boats, and we got a couple of Carly floats into the water as well. We obviously examined the ship. She was showing no immediate signs of sinking. That's burning and listing. I suppose she was listing at, or perhaps an angle of 45 degrees. And the question of sinking was, we didn't know whether she would sink or not, because she was full of buoyant ballast. As she wasn't a warship, she was a converted merchant ship. In other words, an AMC, been converted as a warship. And she was full of buoyant ballast, which was empty oil drums. And every unused space down below, the cargo holds had been made into mess decks and into offices and everything else, ammunition stores and so on. All the spare spaces had been filled with these empty oil drums, and this is what was known as buoyant ballast. So in theory, the ship couldn't sink. But the fire just took hold. And we sat in the boats and from time to time went aboard to see what could be done. We tried to rig up a radio set. How, I don't know. I have no knowledge of that. The experts said, well, we might be able to send out a signal in this way or that, but they weren't able to do it. We got some of the oil drums onto the deck and found some paint and brushes, and we painted on these SOS, HMS Malvernian, and our approximate position, and dumped them over the side. I did hear after the war from Admiralty that a few of these had been picked up in due course, but we dumped those over the side, hoping that they'd be seen. At that time, we had no serious thoughts of leaving the ship. Number one, McIlwain, Lieutenant McIlwain, who was an R&R officer, and who was a particular chum of mine, and who virtually took charge of the decisions, although Captain Robertson, Commander Robertson, the commanding officer, was a survivor. McIlwain was the sort of working boss, and he was a real old seaman. His father had been a seaman before him, as my father was, and he said, Mike, he said, we'll think about leaving the ship when we're sure she's going to sink. I said, I always remember my old dad telling me, as long as your ship floats, stick by her. And we sat by the ship, at least I did, and those who went away with me, we sat by the ship for, I think it was 5 or 6 days, sitting in the lifeboats, hoping that something would come along, but nothing did come along. And things were really getting a bit dreary, because you could smell the burning bodies, or at least you felt you could smell them. This was, I suppose, the overriding sensation that you had. You felt all the time you could smell the bodies burning in the ship. And it was purely a question of just sitting there and hoping that something would come along. And morale, obviously, was was getting low, because we knew we weren't on a shipping lane. So we'd branched off the convoy routes to go on our patrol area, and very rarely did ships depart from the convoy routes. There were convoy routes, there were shipping lanes, and these were the shipping lanes that were protected either by our own escort, the convoy escorts, destroyers and frigates and what have you, or insofar as space permitted by aircraft. We knew we were off the shipping routes, and the chances of anything coming along were pretty remote, but all the time we were hoping that, you know, perhaps the Admiralty would realise, which obviously would, because they weren't able to contact us, that something was adrift, and would send out somebody to look for us. But nothing came along. So on the fifth or the sixth day, I don't know which day it was, the old man called us all together and said, well, look, we can't carry on like this. Let's send one of the boats away. We'd already sent one of the boats away with the seriously wounded, by the way. This was the next day. And at that time we had only the two boats, and we'd sent one away with the seriously wounded. And it's only recently, fairly recently, in fact, I got a telephone call a couple of months ago from a chap who was the canteen manager in the Malvernium, a chap named Prescott. And he sent me some official medical reports. These are how he got hold of them, I don't know, but these are the only reports I've seen, Admiralty reports on the sinking of the Malvernian. And the first boat with the seriously wounded on board had been picked up a couple of days later and got home, because we knew nothing about this.
They'd been sent just in the direction of Europe, had they?
Well, I don't know. I don't know which way they went. And I would imagine they had no equipment on board, but obviously the way to to steer would not be east, would not be towards the French coast. The alternatives were southeast, or little to the south of east, to the Portuguese or Spanish coasts, or northeast to the British Isles, you see. And I imagine, like us, they had no equipment on board. They had no compass. They may have done, but we had none of that equipment. It was all lost. Anyhow, I heard after the war that they'd been picked up within about 2 days, but we knew nothing of it then. Anyhow, about the fourth or fifth day, the old man one morning got us together and said, well, look, we can't carry on like this. I want volunteers to take a boat away, and hopefully contact a ship or a convoy and get help sent back to us. So I volunteered to take one of the boats away, much to McIlwain's disgust. He said again, well, look, Mike, he said, the ship's still afloat. Bloody well stick by her. And I said, no, I said, I just want to get away. So we pushed off one morning. we had in the lifeboat another RNR chap, Dudgeon, who'd been on the North Atlantic run for many years, sailing from Glasgow across the North Atlantic for many years, and he reckoned that he knew the North Atlantic inside out. You know, he's like fishermen who claim they've only got to look over the side and look at the water and they can tell where they are. And I don't know how long we've been. We set off in high spirits. I remember starting a song as we pushed away, and some encouraging comments. About 30 in the lifeboat. We had a couple of wounded chaps there, not seriously wounded, but wounded nevertheless. One had got shrapnel or something through one of his feet. And the coxswain, Petty Officer King, had got a very nasty wound in his backside, a very, very nasty wound. A chunk of his backside had just been carved away. That had been bandaged up as best we could. We pushed off. And I don't know how long we'd been in the lifeboat, perhaps a week or so, before we saw anything at all, or thought we saw anything at all. And one night, Dudgeon said he saw lights there, right ahead. Nobody else could see lights. Looked and looked and looked, and nobody else could see lights. And the consensus of opinion was that it was phosphorescence in the water, because under certain conditions you get a lot of phosphorescence in the water, which can be mistaken for lights. And had they been lights, and Dudgeon was insistent that they were lights, they could only have been in one place, and this was the south coast of Ireland, being a neutral country. I mean, if it had been the UK, there'd be no lights there. If it had been the French coast, there'd be no lights there, you see. And we knew it couldn't be further south. It couldn't have been Spain or Portugal. It just couldn't have been there, because we'd been heading roughly in a northeasterly direction. And we had to, at night, we had to steer by the stars, pick out the North Star when we could, and set a course, keep our eyes on the stars at daytime, during the day. Really, the only way we could steer would be by seeing the sun come up. If the sun came up over there, well, we knew bloody well, that's the east, and if that's the east, the way we want to go is roughly there, you see. So this was the only way we had of going in the direction we wanted to go. Anyhow, after Dudge saying that, being sure that he'd seen these lights, and being sure that it was the Irish coast, and it had to be the southern or southwestern coast of Ireland, we decided, or he decided, or somebody decided, that we were going to make for the for Northern Ireland. We're going to make for Londonderry. And I can still see that night very, very clearly. There was a strong wind blowing, and the sea was, I suppose, very choppy rather than big waves. And the tops of the waves were just flecked with white. And I was at the tiller for, well, my whack during the night, perhaps a couple of hours during the night, and we were belting hell for leather up the west coast of Ireland. And by then, I suppose, a lot of us must have been light-headed, because the next morning, you know, we're in a 27-foot lifeboat with a homemade sail. We had a homemade sail. We found a spar and some canvas, and we had a sort of square sail we'd rigged up on the boat, and we were belting hell for leather up the west coast of Ireland. And lo and behold, the next morning, Dudgeon said that, looking over the side, and there was Londonderry. And if your experience of the sea has ever come across this, but when you're looking over the side at clouds far away on the horizon, it's very often impossible to say whether these are clouds or whether it's the loom of land. The loom of land away on the horizon can easily be mistaken for clouds, or the other way around, you see. And Dudge was absolutely sure this was Londonderry, and he recognized the shape of the headlands and so on there, and he'd got an uncle who lived a few miles outside Londonderry, who was a farmer, and we were going to land at Londonderry. We were going out to this farm. We were going to have a wonderful time for the next few weeks, and so on and so on and so on. And we had the oars in the boat. We got the oars out and started pulling for Londonderry. But Londonderry just bloody well faded away. It just dissipated. And we're still convinced that we were off the Irish coast. You know, there was no doubts about that at all, absolutely no doubts. And somewhere about the same time, or the next day, or a few days later, we got into some very, very peculiar looking water. And the only navigational aid we had on board was a page from a school atlas of the British Isles. Old Jack Keats had that. And off the north coast of Ireland, there's a little mark on the atlas, which I don't think was identified on that, but Jack Keats remembered having read about the Devil's Whirlpool, which is off the north coast of Ireland. And in the old sailing ship days, the mariners used to avoid this because when they got into this whirlpool, they couldn't get out of it. They just went round and round and round until they got to the vortex and down they went. Now, this was the story. This was, you know, everybody in the lifeboat heard this story, and we believe this bloody story too, because we found ourselves in this peculiar patch of water where the ridges in between the humps, the ridges seem to be going round in a vast circle, and we tried. I can see us now trying to get out of this, you know, nosing the bows of the boat out here to cut across it, and we couldn't bloody well get out. And as I remember it, we were, you know, a couple of days trying to get out of it. We were convinced we were in the Devil's Whirlpool, you know, no doubts about that at all, because, you know, everything seemed to match up. And then one morning we found ourselves in fairly calm water. We'd got out of the Devil's Whirlpool or whatever it was. And then again, Dudge suddenly looked up and said, "Crash, look there." And we looked and couldn't see anything. This was in Estrahal.
In what?
In Estrahal. If you think of the west of Scotland, you know, there's a bit hanging down. You think of the Western Isles. Think of it, there's a long bit hanging down, much like a nose or a long drip from a nose.
Peninsula, yes.
And in Estrahal, there was a naval hospital. We knew there was a naval hospital in Estrahal. And we started pulling for Estrahal, and looking forward to survivor's leave, to pretty little nurses stroking our brows and telling us what wonderful chaps we were and so on, something to drink, plenty to eat and so on. But again, Estrahal disappeared into the distance. And all the time, we were at least 1,000 miles away from there. We were right down somewhere to the west of the Bay of Biscay instead of being up there. I don't know where I thought we were, or where any of us thought we were at the time. I think we're still more or less convinced that we were somewhere in that direction. How the hell? Yes, we were, because one of the worries was that having got there to the north coast of Ireland, that we had to be bloody careful about going northeast, because if we went northeast, we'd just disappear into nothingness. If you can imagine a northeasterly course from the north coast of Ireland, what the hell have you got? You've got Iceland over there, you've got Norway and the rest of them over there, and in between, you've got Sweet Fanny Bloody Adams, except the Arctic. You keep sailing and sailing and sailing until the next thing you bloody well knew, you were up on an ice floe at the North Pole. You see, this was a serious worry with us. You know, it may sound cockeyed, but this was reality to us. As we were convinced that that's where we were. And about that time, we'd probably been in the lifeboat for a fortnight, 14 days or something by then. We'd lost a couple of chaps. A couple of chaps had died. I can see. The problem was water. This was the problem. We had a one or two hard biscuits, very few, and they went in the first few days. The problem was water. We managed before leaving the ship to find a container and some water. And how much water we had, I don't know, perhaps a couple of gallons of water, maybe a little more, not a lot more. And we had a BOT beaker in the boat. BOT beaker is, it looks like the shape of a test tube with a bit of string attached to it. And this is lifeboat equipment. And the lifeboat water containers have got a bung in the top. And you drop this in, attach the piece of string and pulled it out full of water. And this was a BOT beaker. We had this sitting in the middle of the boat, and one of my jobs was to look after that, to ration the water out. And this was a hell of a bloody job. But when we left the ship, we were fairly convinced that we'd be home in a short time. And we knew roughly how far we were from the nearest tip of land in the British Isles. And I didn't give a tinker's bloody cuss where it was. Southern Ireland would have suited me, because that's where I come from near Killarney. So that would have suited me very well, you know, if we'd got there, the world would have been our oyster.